What's so great about? What's so great about?
So great about the podcast that asks great questions and gets great answers. My name is Terry.
My name is Andy.
Andy, how the bloody hell are you?
Very well, Terry, and you?
I too am well.
Good to hear it.
And of course, we're asking the question, what's so great about Wes Anderson? Still. And Andy,
yeah?
We've got another guest this week.
Hello.
This week we've got a writer, producer, voiceover artist, and most importantly, in my eyes, one of the creative geniuses behind one of my favourite shows to go see live, Dream Boom Film Reigns. It's Stephen Colfer.
Hey. Hello. Thank you for having me, Terry and Andy.
Stephen, you're very welcome.
Thank you. This is the first podcast I've done in a while because I did all the Irish podcasts a while ago, and a lot of them won't have you back again.
We're the opposite. We want to cultivate a little troop here.
My dad discovered something during the pandemic that he could do, which was open any podcast app and type my name into it, and it would make a playlist of every podcast I'd ever guested on. So I'd just like to take this opportunity to say hi, Dad.
Hello.
In the future,
hello,
whenever
Mr.
you
Colfer.
Get bored in the future and listen to me talk about Fantastic Mr. Fox.
You're so lucky to have a parent that would, first of all, know how to use a podcast app and listen to it then.
I mean, he knows how to type my name into it and find all those episodes, but don't think he knows how to subscribe to my actual show.
Well, I had the ultimate insult of all because we were at Tony's gig on Saturday in Vicar Street.
And how did he get on? I haven't spoken to him about it yet.
It was great,
He was bloody brilliant.
He was brilliant. It was just like really well done. And like I'm still kind of like in awe of the whole thing. Like just even being up there and doing so well. But geez, even like a Saturday night, you know, the crowd, there was a few people shouting out. And he was just very good at knowing when to address it and when to not address it. But just before he came out, my mom was sitting down with us because she was there too. And she's like, I never listened to your show, but I listened to it when Tony came on. It's like, we need the listens. He doesn't need the listens. So I chose to not take that personally.
Yeah, you're not the only person who's heard that from someone they care about. So
it's rough out here being a podcaster, isn't it?
You have to have a very thick skin in this business.
It was great, though, when we were there on Saturday because we got to meet up with a few of our listeners because most of our listeners are friends and family. So it was great to see some. I'm not going to call them fans because, you know, I'm not getting ahead of myself yet, but it was lovely to see a few of the listeners. Great.
It was incredibly surreal when someone come up and be like, huge fan of your podcast. And I was like, wow, okay.
I think you've got me mistaken with somebody else. I'm not that person.
Someone goes, Andy, and I was looking, I was like, I don't know this guy. And then he's like, oh, I'm a big fan. I was like, oh, like, incredible. I immediately felt like, after every interaction, like, I didn't do enough. I want to just give him the things out of my pockets. I'm like, thank you so much. Thank you for listening to every... I want to just, you know... But, it was quite surreal.
I had a great time seeing him there. It was great. It was lovely... like non-toxic fan base that we're cultivating, even though I said I wasn't going to call them fan base.
Well, you just did now.
Yeah, I know. Yeah,
you met one of them and it went straight to your head. Yeah. You were like, fan base. Yeah. Never mind.
It's like having a record collector
can motivate his fan base to get him two picks at the Oscar for best moment, we can motivate our guys.
What would you say, Stephen, yourself, because obviously you're no stranger to the stage yourself.
Yeah.
Would you have a particular in the last, well, maybe not the last couple of years because there wasn't a whole lot going on, I'd imagine, but just throughout your sort of the shows that you guys have done, like particularly with Dream Gun, is there one or two that like stand out as like a real like, wow, that was an incredible show?
Yeah, they're always kind of weird. They're either very obvious. So there was like, I mean, when we did Lord of the Rings in Vicar Street 3 years ago now.
That long, Jesus.
Yeah, it's yeah. Time doesn't exist anymore. Isn't it weird? I had the thought today. I was like, wow, that's as long as from, because we're in Vigor Street again next month with
Star Wars,
which is the first time we've properly been back. And that gig was supposed to happen on, I think it was like May 23rd, 2020. Mm. So it's been on sale for 2.5 years. And I had the thought that it's been the same time between the junior cert and the leaving cert. Since
oh my god,
because that's the only way I can quantify anything.
Yeah.
Time is a construct. How many junior certs and leaving certs were between it?
That's crazy.
So I mean that was crazy, because it was like, it was just like our distilled audience showed up to that show, you know. So it was just like, you know, it was ideal. We could have just done the film. We didn't have to write jokes in front of that audience. Thankfully we did, but that was great. And then there's odd ones, like every now and then it really clicks somewhere, where, because when we take the show on tour to like Edinburgh and Australia and different places we've taken it to, like it settles into like a sort of third gear in the tours, where you're like you know, because you on fucking Wednesday you get like a half audience or something. You kind of know how it's gonna go. It never goes bad, but it goes into a like a sort of average that you don't find very interesting anymore. Mm. And then every now and then, just out of the blue, it really clicks with everyone. Like we did one of my favorite gigs we ever did in Edinburgh. It was just the last one we did, the first time we brought Film Reads to Edinburgh. We did Jurassic Park. Didn't expect it to go any different to the other shows, which is fine. And just basically what happened was, it was the last show, and everyone who had kind of, because when Film Reads goes on tour, we do the whole lineup, so the show changes every night. It was all an audience who had been to the run at some point previously in the run. They came back for one more. So it was just suddenly like the home crowd, except none of them were from home. They were from earlier in the month, you know? It's stuff like that, you know?
I was going to say, would you notice like a big difference in an audience, say, in Edinburgh compared to Ireland, or, you know, like, or is it kind of, if they get it, they get it? And
if they get it, they get it. There's some stuff that obviously is like, there's localized jokes. I think the fact that it's based on billion-dollar franchises that everybody knows is very helpful at bridging the gap.
Yeah.
Bridging the cultural divide.
Well, this podcast the
globalization
same.
Of film does a great job in making sure that everyone gets our jokes.
Myself and Andy have been podcasting for 10 years. Give or take.
Yeah.
And we are the first good few years that we were just me and him. We log on, what films have you watched? What's in the news? What's been bugging you? We had it broken down into three sections. It was TV and movies, news, and lifestyle. And lifestyle was just came into what grinds our gears, essentially. Yeah. And it was like, oh, well, we're not getting a lot of listeners. We get our little core group of friends. Yeah. And then I was like, well, maybe we need to do something that people will listen to. So, like, we did start doing it on The Simpsons.
Yeah.
And then all of a sudden, then you get like a huge like uptick in, again, because you're saying like it's this thing that everybody can relate to. And kind of like, once we get them in the door for The Simpsons, then we can just waffle on about whatever we want.
Yeah.
and they're here.
And that was the formula. And then about maybe a year ago, then we swapped it to, we were kind of getting to the, I don't want to say the shittier episodes, but like we started on season 4 and we were getting to season 9 now, and it was getting to be a bit hit.
You were like, boy, it's coming.
Yeah. It was coming fast.
Yeah, it's going to come turn into one of those like torture podcasts where you deliberately watch something bad and then dissect it.
We specifically said we don't want to be one of those podcasts.
Yeah.
Season 7 was such a even strong season. We were like, wow, this is like the consistency is brilliant. And then season 8, you're like, one week it's one of the best episodes you've ever seen.
Yeah.
And then we were saying,
the cracks are starting to show.
Chasms. Like, we were watching the chili cook-off one, and we were like, what is this show? Like, it's like, as if,
what happens in the chili cook-off one?
Homer
eats the insanity
Johnny
pepper.
Cash.
Yeah.
Is that one?
But like watching it back, we were like, the Johnny Cash part is the most sane part of the whole episode.
Yeah.
Like, it was like all the characters are like drawn weirdly and act like they're like they, like Mo is like
some background kind of
sniveling like like Homer's like judging his chili and as if like Mo thinks Homer's gonna beat the shit out of him or something. You're like, what is going on in this episode?
Very odd. Like,
Whiplash.
Like the trippy stuff wasn't like the trippy stuff was good in that one, but it was the stuff that was supposed to be non-trippy. It's like they handed that episode to a bunch of other animators and said, "You've seen The Simpsons, like write a 22-minute episode for that." Very odd.
Do you remember while The Simpsons was actually coming out, which moment anyone you remember decided, "Oh, this is it, The Simpsons is done." Like at that time, because there was a few. I remember when Maude was killed,
that was viciously killed. That was one actually.
Very jarring.
I was kind of still too young to realize it was bad, but it was like so cruel and weird.
You still watched
that? I think that upset a lot of people. I have a real distinctive memory of when I was in like youth theater when I was like 15, 16. All of our teachers were like in their early 20s, but we all looked at them as if they were the way I look at 60-year-olds now.
Yeah,
do you know what I mean? And,
so I remember
one of them watched the pie. I mean, I don't think anyone remembers this episode. I only remember it because of this conversation, the Pie Man episode where Homer becomes Pie Man, and it's a parody of the first Sam Raimi Spider-Man movie.
They do the kiss and all.
They do a superhero movie. Yeah. They do the kiss, and it's just Homer throwing pies at people.
Really bad. Now that you mention, I'm like I think I'd actually stop watching, like as in week to week at that point.
Yeah,
you know what I mean.
Yeah.
But like when it came back on, I did a weird experiment because I think I hate myself a little bit. When I came back from Australia, I was living in my parents' house, and I like torrented like season 22 and 23 of The Simpsons.
Yeah.
And I watched them over this because I was unemployed, and I just said, "This is going to be my evening. I'm going to watch these and see if they're any use." And
not even The Simpsons could comfort you.
I have heard rumors from the front line of people watching The Simpsons these days that apparently it's not as bad in the last now to 4 years ago as it was 10 to 14 years ago.
I have heard that too from people
As if like a war pigeon from the, and I'm Stephen Fry up in the mansion, you know, being like, just watching season 7 on repeat.
Yeah, on repeat.
And I'm getting these little pigeons being like, "Oh, it's season 34, episode 9 is not that, it's actually all right."
You know? Okay. A lot of them do say it.
There was one bit of gold in that, like when I did that experiment, and it was very much an outlier, and it was unlike any. It was as if whoever had written it was like, "You know what, I'm actually going to put some thought and craft into it." And it was all to do with like Bart like getting like a malaise of like how his life is the same every day.
He decides to try to
spice it up. The middle part gets a bit weird because they go on like a cruise ship or something, and he's like, "I'm having the best time on the cruise. I don't want to go back to my boring life." Mm. And then he like uses some unreleased DVD to like convince everybody that there's been a plague and they have to stay on the boat or whatever.
What?
Yeah, but that's what I'm saying. Like, you're mining for gold here. That I was like, oh, like the choices that they were doing in the animation and the kind of you know, they used that song by, is it Rykesop, Boys from School, to like show him doing the same thing over and over again. And I was like, I was like, wow. I was like, that like was something.
Did his animation style gradually change as the
It's kind of like those bands who like had great album after great album in the 70s, and then the 80s came around, they have like one hit song
on each album, or something like that.
And it'd be generally terrible. That's pretty much what that is.
Stephen, I want to rip this Band-Aid off now, because me and Andy have been on one of our miniseries on our Patreon. We covered Will Smith's output for the last 10 years. Okay. And this week, we're covering what happened at the Oscars. Because I had been talking about when... Andy's a huge Will Smith fan. And I kind of said, "I don't think this guy's okay." When we were like watching the movies and like seeing that he was doing this, like, "I worst shape of my life" YouTube series. And some National Geographic.
I don't think I can bring it up anymore, but like, did you know Will Smith has a clickbait YouTube channel? It was one of my favorite things to chaotically say in the pub when the conversation was like dulling, you know, because you could just, up until a week ago, you could say that and they'd be like, what? No. And you'd be like, it's exactly what you're imagining. And they go, duh, duh, duh. And it's all just like, you know, it's the thumbnails with the arrows pointing to his face going, like.
I was so confused. I was like, wasn't this guy like, and he still is one of the most famous movie stars in the world. But I'm like, why is he doing all these stuff? Like, why isn't he?
I felt like someone, I think he got on Instagram and YouTube at basically the same time, because he's only fairly new to Instagram too, but like they're incredibly well produced, like they're funny videos, but they're all like,
I had the impression, maybe I'm wrong, I had the impression he like copied the YouTube thing off his son. I thought he was having some kind of like, you know.
I'd believe that.
I want to talk about the slap lads.
That I'm like, it was pure business. Maybe it was him trying to connect with his son. I don't think so. No, seems like he put more effort into
it. I think their relationship.
And any father would be willing to do for his son. So,
I think their relationship is probably strained from After Earth as well. Like, you know, like he was like, you're doing this movie, you know. But I want to talk about it briefly, because we're going to dive in on the Patreon a bit more in depth. But Stephen, I think I'm too invested in it. I think Andy's too invested in it. I would like to see somebody else's opinion on this. What do you think after the Oscars on Sunday?
Thought it was very funny.
Yeah.
I think everything about it is funny. I don't even know where to begin. It's like every... You know the meme of the guy pressing the buttons? It's like that, except there's 100 buttons, do you know? It like has somehow, you know, like, I know there was a lot of like, how can anybody be talking about this when there's a war happening?
Yeah.
But like, it somehow is, somehow it's got its finger in every cultural pie that exists at the moment. I'm not saying that's good. You know,
it was the top story on the news before, like what's happening in Kiev this morning. Somebody said that to me at work. It was like they had the Will Smith story first.
Yeah,
and then
I've never seen such a huge incident like that. Like one that we're like, what? You're watching it, and it's like, what? Like
it makes you think you're living in a simulation.
It's a weird perfect storm of. How did you guys find out? Where were you?
I woke up and I was like, oh, I forgot, you know, the Oscars. Because I have a very toxic relationship with the Oscars. I used to stay up and watch them. In my early 20s, I would stay up and watch them. And I'd be like, oh, it's so exciting. You know, you see Lord of the Rings win 13 awards or, you felt like you're watching history. And then obviously, like, things in my life, I have a wife, I have a child, I don't really have time to stay up till stupid o'clock on a Sunday night. But by and large, I would still always kind of be like, oh well, I agree with a lot of the decisions that they make, until the Joaquin Phoenix Joker award. I was like, oh, I'm like, okay, like I'm kind of done. And I have kind of rallied against the idea that Will Smith put in the best performance of the year for King Richard. I thought his performance in it was very, very hammy. Very.
We did both watch it, and even like I was until Sunday a big Will Smith fan.
That for later.
But because I just thought like, because the whole thing that I liked about him was like, I knew it was cheesy, and I knew it was this sort of faux inspirational, motivational sort of guy, always happy, and then to see him such a weak move, like a fragile, weak-minded move, to just, and the privilege to just think that I'm just gonna get up here, and like there's really two sides to it. It's like, one, I'm gonna get up here and no one's gonna stop me, and I'm gonna walk back to my seat and no one's gonna tackle me to the ground, and then also like it's, you know. And also, here's your Best Actor award, and everyone's standing and cheering. Like, get this man in jail. Like,
jail. Watch him out.
Jail's
it's
too good
wild. I don't know who the guy, I don't know who, like, the stage manager of that show is, but the idea that, like, I don't think anything more wrong can happen now. Like, when a couple of years ago, literally, the Oscar that is the best one to win, they said the wrong thing, they fucked that up.
Yeah.
And then they kind of, like, they didn't stop that, you know? Yeah. It was like whoever was, who was it? Was it Jimmy Kimmel was hosting it, I think? Like, yeah. He had to, like,
he did a kind of decent job,
like he was like whispering in people's ears, yeah. And then the guys who didn't win had to be the ones who just like
I'm sorry,
him
this
or, like,
is wrong.
Just like you guys won, come on, like yeah. I'm just gonna have to. Clearly, like, no one's going to help.
I look like your man eventually did the right thing because he got up and started giving a speech and he's like, oh, by the way, we didn't win. Moonlight, you won. It's like, I'm still going to thank a load of people just while I'm up on stage.
I'm still going to try it at my moment. Yeah. And, and then the same, I'm trying to picture like who, when it happened, did anyone even consider for a second we should stop? I mean, you can see on Chris Rock's face, there's like a moment where he's waiting for...
He looks off stage.
He's assuming that he's not live anymore. Do you know what I mean? He's like, still going out?
I still need to keep talking now.
Am I still on? You know?
He looks off stage a couple of times.
He waits for the confirmation. He's
okay, and then he kind of is like, I could say something. He's like, anyway, we're here to give out a documentary. And like, even like, he did very well to kind of get back into it.
Chris Rock's stock has been raised.
That's what I thought. But then like,
because of the joke, people don't think so.
I don't know. I don't know how anybody expected me to get any work done on Monday when all this was happening. I was just like, just on my phone beside me here. I'm like, what's happening now? Like,
you'll never believe this. He was asked to leave and he refused.
That's
what was out today.
What's up with the fucking slow trickle of information about this? Why is there now a fucking commission that's slowly leaking? Slowly little bits, little discoveries
are being made.
That it took everyone who saw it 5 minutes to figure out.
Yeah,
you know?
Exactly.
Do you know what's something that I've noticed? There's a very slow trickle coming to me of who actually won an Oscar. Did Samuel L. Jackson win an Oscar? Did that actually happen?
He got a Lifetime Achievement Award on the Saturday.
Okay, that makes a little more sense as to why I didn't know at the time. But I only found that out today.
That was another thing that they were like, they fucked up the Oscars so much that, like, you know, they cut a bunch of these below the line awards. Like, editing.
Poor Hans Zimmer couldn't like make a speech about his.
I think Dune won 6 awards, and I don't think any of them were on the main show. You know what I mean? I think they were all like technical ones that they didn't do, or like. But you'd rather watch fucking Flash hit the Speed Force or Army of the Dead win fucking Twitter.
I'm kind of glad that happened. As much as like the Snyder Bros are insane and need to be stopped, I'm kind of glad that happened because now they'll never do it again. You know, like if they did it once, they'll do it again. And they can't just be like, all right, we're banning DC movies from the... There'll always be a new one for them to nominate for this thing, you know?
Like, that Speed Force thing, I was like, it's from the last year, obviously. It's like, no, it's the most cheer moment of all time.
And I was like, it all time?
Because like Neo doing Bullet Time was one of the ones.
Brilliant.
I'm like, I'm sorry. This movie, like, Andy, you look like I'm speaking Swahili to you.
I don't know what you guys are talking about at all.
There was a Twitter vote to see, like, the most cheer moment from the movies.
Most cheer.
The moments that made you go cheer the most. Like, you know, I wanted you to think yourself. What's yours? Okay. What I love is that this is a bullshit question, but we all have an opinion on it.
I know. This is what they want.
I didn't cheer that at all.
This is what they want. It's like, I don't cheer movies. I sit quiet.
You go, Andy, you go, fucking yes, or come on, that's your cheer.
Big cheer.
I think the thing about debating who wins the Oscars is that, I haven't read, maybe they've shook it up since. It doesn't have like an incredibly boring style of voting system that just sort of the most average thing will always win. Isn't that something to do with how they twig the numbers, you know?
It's like a coefficient thing. So, like,
it's different for each category or something like that. So it's not necessarily who gets the most votes. It's like things are ranked.
Yeah.
And then so you can give weight to different films.
Huh. Like Coda wouldn't.
I think it's definitely like that for the Best Picture, which is why Best Picture is often something that, like, no one would really ever say was bad. And some people would say was great. But it's never anything divisive because it's like the average. Out of fives, the threes and fours always win it.
That kind of describes Coda this year, that they're saying it was like, nobody would turn around and say, this is the best movie of last year. But whatever way it works, it always evens out, which I think is very silly. Like, the best picture is, you know, number one. You pick your number one, the amount of number ones.
Best picture, like, the whole shtick of this podcast, even, is that, like, Terry's a big film buff, and I am not, basically. And I'm the sort of film watcher who really annoys film buffs, because I'm, like... whatever the movie's trying to give me, I'm just like this is shy. I'm very dismissive of this sort of stuff. So I always found I'm always saying to Terry, the best picture nominations are a big do not watch list, as far as I'm concerned. If they're on that list, I'll never see them.
The only way you're going to watch them is on the podcast.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure that the podcast is purely a vessel for Terry to make me watch the movies that no one else will watch.
And we can talk about it. Nobody else wants to talk about it with me.
Well, is that a great segue to get into the old
of Fantastic Mr. Fox?
Yes.
Who am I, Kylie? Why a fox? Why not a horse or a beetle or a bald eagle? I'm saying this more as like existentialism, you know?
I don't know what you're talking about, but it sounds illegal.
Wes Anderson creates a triumphant animated storytelling.
Honey, I'm 7 non-fox years old now. My father died at 7.5. I don't want to live in a hole anymore. And I'm going to do something about it.
Don't buy this tree, Foxy. This is Bogus, Bunce, and Bean, 3 of the meanest, nastiest, ugliest farmers in this valley. You're moving into the most dangerous neighborhood for someone of your type of species.
Your comments are valuable, but I'm going to ignore your advice.
The cuss you are.
Are you cussing with me?
No, you cussing with me?
Don't cuss and point
at me. You're
going
to cuss with somebody. You're not going to...
Just buy the tree.
Okay.
Rolling Stone raves, Fantastic Mr. Fox is a movie that deserves to be called groundbreaking. It looks like nothing you've seen before.
We look good.
Yeah, we do.
It's proof that Pixar doesn't have a monopoly on heartfelt and funny animation.
Pensez-vous que l'hiver sera rude?
I'm asking if he thinks we're in for a hard winter.
Academy Award winner George Clooney.
What's this thing you do, the whistle with the clicking sound?
That's my trademark.
Academy Award winner Meryl Streep.
You really are a quote-unquote fantastic fox.
I try.
Jason Schwartzman, Bill Murray, Willem Dafoe, Owen Wilson. Woo!
Whack Bass, real simple. There's 3 grabbers, 3 taggers, 5 twig runners, and a player at Whack Bass. Center tagger lights a pine cone, chucks it over the basket, and the whack batter tries to hit the cedar stick off the cross rock.
Fantastic Mr. Fox.
Twig runners dash back and forth until the pine cone burns out, then you count up however many score downs it adds up to and divide that by 9.
That was, of course, the trailer for Fantastic Mr. Fox, the 2009 film, directed by Wes Anderson, written by Wes Anderson and Noah Baumbach. Would you care for a bit of boff, guys? Stephen, that means box office and fun facts.
Please.
Anybody care to guess the budget?
I like that you've separated box office from fun fact, because literally the most boring aspect.
How dare you, sir? I eat and sleep this data.
Go on then.
Who would care to take a stab at the budget? Stephen, you're our guest. I'll give it to you first.
$50 million.
Okay. Andy?
In the eyes of the public, he'd had a couple of, not bombs, but not hits before this. I'm going to say $40 million.
40 bang on is the budget.
Whoa.
Yes.
Does this guy specialize in clay? Does he know how much? Do you know exactly how much clay costs and how much? How many cubic meters of clay were used in the creation of this movie?
An importer of clay knowledge is finally paying off.
Care to take a stab at the opening weekend gross? Now, Andy, I haven't actually given you the opening weekend again because it only opened like 2 cinemas.
Okay, good.
So I've given you the wide opening weekend. Okay.
Oh, okay. So the whole weekend.
Opening weekend.
Mm. US.
Okay.
US, and it's wide. It's like 1,000 plus, you know, theaters.
Yeah.
It's not 4,000. It's not like a fucking Avengers release, you know?
Okay. Okay.
Steven, you can go. You can jump in here anytime you want.
A weekend is throwing me. I don't know how it to divide by 52, so I'm not.
I'm but it's not running all year, Stephen.
No, this is why I know I'll be shit. I thought but that's insane. What I just said is insane. So I backed out knowing that I would pull some bullshit to get to my figure and would be embarrassingly wrong. But
see, we do this
your
every
process
week,
is more interesting.
What I've started to realize having guests on is that nobody thinks about this stuff as much as I do. They're like, what? Huh? Opening weekend?
Yeah. Of what? I'm going to go 4 million.
Okay, there's a good baseline to start.
All right.
How many?
You're overthinking
theaters
it.
You're are we over, talking here?
Over a thousand.
This is more just pull a number out.
3 million. Okay. 3 million.
10 million.
Jesus.
I feel like you played us there.
Oh, well.
I don't know why.
So,
I feel 10
million
played.
Was the opening weekend. Keep that in mind, fellas. 10 million was the opening weekend.
Yeah.
The domestic total?
I have a funny feeling this film flopped. Did it?
Well,
I'll tell you after.
It's like made.
I'll go with 30.
Okay, you're going 30.
So the budget was 40.
Yeah.
I'm going to say 45.
Domestic total, 45?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, in America.
Yeah.
Where America. It's from. Yeah. Yes. All right, yeah, go for it.
21 sure. million.
Oh, motherfucker. Wow.
Worldwide?
All right, last one, worldwide.
I'm going to go 45 because like that's what I was actually thinking. Okay. And then I just, you Duren Brown me and I didn't want to change. Even though I was given more information, I didn't want to change what I'd already said.
What
so,
opening
yeah.
Daily Mail weekend was it?
I will say 60 million worldwide.
46 million.
Oh, that's
all right.
That's yours.
Okay, not terrible.
Yeah,
not terrible.
That's yours.
Room for improvement for the two of you. So I'll put it down on the report card.
Thank you.
I mean, you didn't know this. You looked it up.
I'm the teacher.
It's because you looked it up before and you memorized it.
Yeah. I have it written down.
You know what? That's a good point. This whole time, I've been thinking you're some sort of expert.
I actually, whenever you do the box office game, Andy, I fare pretty terribly. So,
but you know what? Because we started doing it during the MCU. What's so great about the MCU?
That throws
so
the whole thing off.
That throws the whole thing off because you're dealing with billions then. And then everything seems like a flop now. Everything seems like it tanked after that.
If you can get the budget, you can work it out from there, I always find. This film, Fantastic Mr. Fox, was Wes Anderson's fave Roald Dahl book. And he was delighted to learn that nobody had adopted it at the time for him to make it. Because he basically said they had done Matilda, they had done the animated BFG, and it was like... Luckily, this was left there for him. It is mostly an analog production, would you believe it or not? Like, there's no CGI used, but a few bits of digital photography. An example of this, no CGI. He says an example of this was there's a record player, and instead of moving the record for every time an animal moved, they would like roll it around like three times. Photographer would digitally capture it and then put it on a loop. So it's just off to the side. But everything else was
so
proper
stop
motion.
So even when they're like going through tunnels in the water and all, like how are they doing that?
Oh, yeah. It's a proper stop motion. Like,
oh, jeez.
Yeah, so that's...
How do they do the waterfall? Does it say that in your notes?
It doesn't say that.
When they're standing in front of the waterfall.
It doesn't say
how
that
do they
in
do
my
that?
Big book of Wes Anderson.
What's the point?
Yeah. Well, it should be bigger then.
Well, it's an interview with him, and the man asks him, is there any CGI? And he says no. So I'm taking him at his word.
They didn't say, what about the waterfall?
Wes. Interesting point, Wes. What about the waterfall, though?
Yeah.
Okay, all the sets were miniature to match the models. So, like, the big Mr. Fox is just a little over 1 foot. And then if it was coming from a distance, he would use a miniature one.
Right.
So I find all this really fascinating, actually, stop motion animation. Yeah. Like, it's so painstaking, you know, it's so detailed. Yeah. Here's something I actually found really interesting, that, like, him and the cast recorded all the original audio on location at a farm in New England, acting out the script like a film, just not actually getting it on camera, and they recorded all the sound.
So they were all together acting?
Yeah.
Right.
As opposed to being in
Studio
a booth,
2,
you know?
Yeah.
I fucking love that shit.
That's great. Like,
that is, yeah, that's my jam.
That is.
I wonder, does it come across? Probably. I think it would get you into the zone, right? Into
I
the.
Think can, so. Look, I think yeah. when Clooney, especially, you can kind of feel him when he's running or something like that. Like,
I think something you can definitely tell that is happening in this film is the actors are actually all together. And they're recording their lines together, and it's not just you know, I think even Pixar just get Tom Hanks in to read against one guy who isn't drawing that day, you know, and then that's his lines done, and then everyone else comes in later, you know.
But you'd miss something. You'd miss the sort of the energy or the chemistry.
Yes, exactly. Like, yeah, you know, yeah, and this film like thrives on that, you know.
Yeah.
He said the script was rewritten and parts were re-recorded as they were animating the film because it took 2.5 years. So he had to go do pickups. So like some of Willem Dafoe's stuff was in Paris. I think Meryl Streep was in London when they had to go finish it off because they're all off doing different projects. It just shows you how, like I say, how long it took to do. I think Darjeeling Limited was 2006. So it's like...
Yeah.
Three years in between.
I was surprised that he was able to get Clooney and Streep.
This on to my next point, that he wrote this iteration of Mr. Fox with Clooney in mind, kind of like we were talking about Royal Tenenbaums. He wrote Royal for Gene Hackman, and like he'd already discussed writing Steve Zissou for Bill Murray. He basically said Michael Clayton was an inspiration. You want to root for Clooney even when he's at his worst, and he's at his worst quite a lot in this film. And I totally get what you mean. Clooney has that quality, that roguish quality, for lack of a better term. Like, even if he's a bit of a shit, you're like, oh, but what a charmer. Like,
of course.
Yeah, it's Clooney.
He's Clooney. He's kind of Clooney in every movie. You know what I mean?
Well, that's your big.
That's not always
gripe.
A bad thing.
That's your big gripe with him. Like,
I mean, I don't mind Leonardo DiCaprio being Leonardo DiCaprio in every movie,
I remember me and you having a very heated argument about Gravity, and you were saying how it shouldn't have been George Clooney in the role.
It was just George Clooney and Sandra
Clooney's
Bullock.
In space.
Clooney and Bullock in space acting exactly like you would expect them to act.
Yeah, there's nothing for George Clooney to heist in space.
Yeah,
so, exactly.
You're like, what are you doing up there, man?
His soul from his body.
I don't buy it.
I almost had a panic attack watching that film, though. That was the idea of being untethered in space is...
Yeah.
It's like
the first time I ever even thought about it, of like, if he doesn't grab that thing right now, he's just going to
gone
off
forever.
You know, yeah.
Terrifying. Never gone to space.
Really makes you think, huh?
Last note I have, Jarvis Cocker was cast as the on-screen narrator in early versions of the film, but it was changed due to test audiences finding it baffling. So he only has one line of dialogue that is not sung in the film. So apparently he was supposed to be in the whole thing.
Wow. I need to hear this. What do they mean baffling?
I don't know, but like he said, the test audiences just didn't respond. They were very confused by him just standing there.
I get the impression he's a bit of a mumbler.
Yeah, I mean,
you know?
Yeah, I don't, yeah.
I feel like his songs are kind of like the verses anyway are kind of mumbly. You know what I mean?
Racketeers. I love his song.
Trying to think. So there isn't actually narration in the film, right?
No, there's not.
It wasn't like he was replaced. They cut all the.
No, they cut all the
interesting.
Narration.
Maybe it was just one Wes Anderson too far for an adaptation of Fantastic Mr. Fox. You know,
it's
gone critical, guys. It doesn't make sense. It doesn't make fucking sense anymore. You've played with it too much. You know.
So, Stephen, we gave you a choice of, you know, what was left, what hadn't been bagsied, and you chose this one. Can you tell us why?
So, first of all, I think I'm similar to Wes in attitude towards the book in terms of, like, when I hear the words Fantastic Mr. Fox, I can smell it, you know? Like, and I don't even just mean the smell of the book. I mean the smell of, like, I remember there was, like, my copy had, like, this really strong duct tape from when we moved house stuck to the front cover of it. Like, I can smell specifically that, you know? And also, somehow, This was the first Wes Anderson film I saw.
Really?
Right. Yeah, I had a... I figured out what it was, which is that as the original ones were coming out, Royal Tenenbaums came out, and my... What year was that?
Like that was 2001.
2001. Yeah. Yes, perfect. That makes sense because that means I would have been 12. And 12 or 13, maybe. And
I would have been 14.
I thought
yeah, so we're 2 years
it was something to do with the royal family, you know, the British greasy sitcom, The Royal Family.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
Oh,
yeah. Yeah,
yeah. And I didn't like Tomlinson. That. Maybe it's good. I never watched it again. But my gut impression as a child watching that was like, I don't like watching greasy British people. Yeah.
I kind of felt
chairs,
the same. Yeah,
which was probably the point.
Yes.
You know? And yeah. I assumed that. That had something to do with that, so I wrote off Wes Anderson as a whole.
This fucking guy
for making
that greasy
the British
creep.
Sitcom, The Royal Family. So, but then he made an adaptation of her old Al book, and I saw the trailer, and I was like, "That's very unlike the idea I had."
Where's the greasy
maybe
people
should,
sitting on the sofa?
Maybe I should go rectify this. And although, when you think about it, it would make more sense that they adapted Fantastic Mr. Fox, considering it's this like British property.
Yeah.
Yeah. Because what you were saying earlier about oh, this book was left on the table. This book is like 20 pages long. Mm. That's why it was left on the table.
Yeah.
You know?
I remember that, like having that. It's a short story. Like,
yeah,
you know,
yeah.
Like we're big, we had a large selection of Roald Dahl books in my house. And I'm like you, I think Fantastic Mr. Fox was my favorite one. Probably because it was short and sweet, but it had animals in it as well.
Yeah.
Like, you know.
I definitely think it was because I could read it. I think
that helps. Like,
do you know what I mean?
Yeah. The first time you realize, like, I can
read
this.
It cover to cover and get the sticker from my teacher for reading a book, you know?
It's going to leave a good imprint on you.
Yeah.
Like, the other one, thinking back on the other Roald Dahl stuff, like, as a kid, like, stuff like The Twits.
The Twits was kind of my jam.
But,
I always liked The Twits.
It's all also, like, kind of, like, we had it, and I liked it, but now when I think of it as an adult, I'm like, that's a very strange book for a child. I know all of the stuff is kind of a little bit strange, but like,
that's the thing. Like, if I kind of like, there's always slightly ominous undertones in like Roald Dahl books, I find, like, even some way less than others, but like, I feel like that's kind of the appeal almost, is like, there's a little bit of like, there's always like a dark character or a bad character, or you know what I mean? It's just,
there's always the someone who like murder a child at the drop of a hat to teach another child a lesson about why watching films and television is bad, you know?
Yeah, exactly.
Like,
you know?
It's anyone's ready to do it at any time.
Exactly.
Often even the character is considered good. So as a child, you're just really like, well, I don't know who to trust now.
I don't know where I stand.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, well, like, in terms of the actual rewatch, did you watch it again before coming on here?
I did, yeah. I watched it on a train last night, and then I was pleasantly surprised to see that there were trains in it. And I got to be very cozy on a train, a train at nighttime, watching Fantastic Mr. Fox on my laptop, as Wes intended.
That does actually sound great.
And there was that shot of the train after the little train set scene.
Nice.
I was like, that's bloody, look, there I am. I'm in the film.
It was meant to be this.
I'm in the film. Not that I fucking looked out the window of that train once to see any of the lovely Irish countryside that was going by.
but this screen was really giving it to me.
But it could have been me. It could have been me. Yeah.
And Andy,
you know, the animals were voiced by George Clooney and Meryl Streep on my screen. Look outside, I'm not getting that.
I'm not looking outside.
So Andy, to pull off the band-aid, this is the part of the podcast I dread always. But what did you think of it?
Okay. I thought, just for context, like, the whole sort of point of this is because I generally wasn't a Wes Anderson fan, so Terry's trying to show me what's so great about it. And so far, the only one that's really...
Podcast.
What other show did you think he made?
It's like, and you're back to just fucking watch it with Terry and Andy. But so far, The Life Aquatic is the one that actually I liked the best. And I thought Rushmore and I thought Royal Tenenbaums were good, but I kind of still felt like a bit of an outsider watching it. You know what I mean? Like I was saying last week, like I didn't get the like I was never in it going like oh I'm really into this, like yes this is great. I was kind of like okay, well you know there's that's funny and you know that looks cool and that you know all that sort of stuff. And I kind of got that again from this one, to be honest with you. I didn't like it, just it looks and sounds so good. I just wish that the story grabbed me a bit better. I felt like a bit of an outsider again watching it, where I was kind of like just appreciating stuff like that's good. I like that. And that's, you know, but it just but the thing is, this is one of the few Wes Anderson movies that I'd actually seen before, and I remember liking it in 2009. So like, I don't know, but I just thought I felt like a little. It didn't quite connect with me this time, if I'm being honest. I'm sorry. I know you both love it.
Disappointing. Yeah. Disappointing, Andy.
Very, very disappointing. Yeah, it just maybe now I have a feeling if I watch things in bed, I get a bit sleepy, that it impacts my view of the.
Well,
of
course
the movie.
It would.
But I was awake for the. I was awake for the whole thing. All right?
I was conscious. Yeah.
I did my job.
I mean, you know, it also didn't connect with any of the children that it was apparently made for. So, you know.
Yeah, like, I can't believe.
It is weird, you know. You're like, who is this for? You know?
Yeah, that was
yeah, no, it is. It is. But that's not what anyone was paid to do.
But this is an interesting thing to talk about, like, for animation. Yeah. Like, animation isn't solely based for kids, you know what I mean?
Yeah, but I feel like this was geared towards, this was supposed to be one for kids as well as adults, like, you know, like
I think
like a Pixar
that whoever commissioned it and whoever Fox, was the producer, yeah. who was the fucking producer on this thing? It's gonna turn out I'm completely wrong, but here's what my guess is.
Go on.
Someone was like, great, we got Roald Dahl, we got Wes Anderson, who's like at this point is still only what, three films in, really?
This is his,
you know, so it's like we tried to
sixth film.
You know, it's like when they paired up like Edgar Wright and the Scott Pilgrim property, like they're trying to find two things that are going to gel and then be like, all right, this is roughly what we want, here's 40 million, off you go. I don't necessarily think they thought they were going to get something about, like, I love the sort of reoccurring theme in all of Wes Anderson's films, which is like, they're all about like roles and titles and jobs and like, what are you? And he took something called Fantastic Mr. Fox and was like, what makes a fox fantastic, you know? And it's like, a lot of it is just like, and with a lot of like, in this, you've got the actual story of the book that they have to play out, and then they kind of add on to that. But even though they add on to it, they just sort of do the end a second time.
Yeah,
you know.
Yeah,
because it ends when they go and steal all the chickens from the. Like,
yes.
Yeah, when they go and steal, and it's like, we took everything. Like, that's how the book kind of ends, and the farmers are just sitting there. They don't have a big rescue mission or anything like that. Like.
Right, so they added on extra.
Oh, they added on this, and like obviously the thing about him being a newspaper man and stuff like that, like all these little flourishes that have been put in the book. Like you say, the book is 20 pages. It's very basic. Yeah. So like he puts his Wes Anderson schmear all over it, definitely.
I mean, he wrote himself into it.
Yeah.
So.
Is he in it?
Like, do you know what this film needs?
Yeah.
Me in the film, and then a second character. Also based on me in the film.
His brother actually plays Christopherson.
Yeah.
His brother plays Christopherson.
Oh,
which I think he's been in all the other films as
I'll tell you something, he's lucky those characters are great, you know, because if you fuck that up, like it would have been the most
unforgivable.
It's a weird thing because I think the performance is really good, but it's really I guess that's what they're going for. It's really down the middle.
Yeah.
Like his whole thing is that he is really gifted and talented, but also he's just like, there's nothing outlandish about him. He's not like Mr. Fox. He's not like Ash, who have these kind of.
I think he's like, what I like about him, about Ash and Christopherson, is that Ash is kind of like, I get the impression. So, you know what, in Rushmore, you've got the auteur, the child genius auteur kind of thing.
Yeah.
Like. I think Ash might be actually what Wes Anderson was when he was young.
A little
and
bit.
and the guy in Rushmore is who he saw himself as, but like everyone around him just saw Ash, you know. I think it's a more honest portrayal of like what 14-year-olds are like when they think they're great and they get into watching Tarantino movies. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, definitely.
And then I like that Christopherson is just like, he's also weird. He's a weirdo as well, but he's just confident about himself, and he's not trying to impress anyone, and therefore impresses everyone. You know, and Ash just fundamentally does not understand that. You know,
he's so comfortable in himself. Yeah. That's the thing with Christopherson, which makes him a very endearing character.
Yeah, yeah. You know? He doesn't do any. He's not performative. Everything he does is sincere. And that's all he's doing.
I have to say, like, I found, like, even with the movies that I don't particularly click with, it, like, there's still so much to appreciate. You know what I mean? Like, I knew, that's why I was interested in your fun facts today, Terry, because I was interested to see how the actual thing was made. Like,
motion.
even the way their fur like bristles slightly all the time, and
he said he wanted like, real fur. He's like, I needed real hair today.
Yeah,
he's like, I couldn't fake it. He's like, for me, I can't abide that. He said I needed.
And is that from, like, this may be a very like stupid question, but is that from them going in and moving the character slightly for the next shot and move, you know what I mean?
Oh yeah, they have to like do it each time. Like.
And their hair just bristles. Like that's what I found. Like they didn't try and correct the hair.
Oh, is that like an unintentional, like it just kind of happened and they went with it sort of thing?
Well, that's what I'm wondering. Like,
fingerprints in Wallace and Gromit, you know, they're like, let's just make a part of it, like that kind of thing.
Like we'll move the fur, you know, while we correct this, and if it moves, then whatever. But the whole thing, like, because it looked kind of like, it just looked cool. Like, it looked...
Like, there is a picture, sorry for folks at home that can't see it, but, like, there's of what the originals...
Wow, like, folks, you're really missing out here, folks.
Like, like, see that picture there, like, when he's wrapped up, like, the bottle there? You're like, oh, yeah, that, you know, it translates completely to screen. Like, you know, it's not faked at any point, like.
It definitely kept the essence of the you know, Roald Dahl, and you know that whole, like, world, that
the 4K transfer or whatever on Disney Plus, like, it looks fantastic.
Great.
I've never seen it look so good. You know what I mean? Like, I've watched this film, I don't know, more than 10 times. I'd say it's one of my favorite animated films ever.
Oh,
I just,
big words,
makes me, you
really pause the TV, get on your knees, and read all the little labels that have jokes on them.
I love all that.
That
stuff
are apparently what make these films good.
Yeah. Like,
I'd say there's so much as well.
Oh, they're great. They're great. You know, like, I love all the, even in the final scene, I was like looking at all the shops and all the little things, and I was like, I fucking bet you this is like, oh, that's the pub Roald Dahl drank in, or that's the, you know what I mean?
Like, like that,
and there's nice, there's something authentic about stuff like that, that I feel like you can always tell, you know?
Yeah.
In the paper, when he cuts out the bandit hat for sale thing, the text around it is actually from Fantastic Mr. Fox book. So it's like, oh, from the road. Yeah. So like,
I did pause it on the train last night to read his column when it comes up.
Oh, yeah.
And it's all just like, if I may interject, dear reader, the fact that I sit here writing to you, when I say, therefore, I am a fox, what I mean is, it's all just like walking
pontificating.
Well, I love it. Yeah. Yeah.
Cool. And I loved like the way they moved. Like, it's not like, it's smooth, but it's kind of rigid. Like, the ups and the sides like are so like, perfectly, like, if they're jumping up, they're perfectly straight, and if they're going this way, they're you know, like, it seemed nice, and like, in his own weird way, nice and symmetrical. I know the way his movies are very pleasing and symmetrical and things like that, and
really,
I just
very rigid,
that's, you know, it kind of, those ups and downs were quite sort of rigid. I quite like that, you know.
We talked about last time when we were doing, or when we were talking about Life Aquatic. And I was saying there's a score in Life Aquatic that's done by Mark Mothersbaugh of Devo. And that was his last movie they did together. And I was like, oh, I'm going to miss him doing the music, because I was like, oh, some of the stuff in Life Aquatic is my favorite that they've done. And then I forgot, like, as the first bit of score you hear in this, I'm like, oh, yeah, this is way more suited. You know, this is a perfect change. I don't think Mark Mothersbaugh His thing is a bit more like abstract or something, it seems.
Yeah.
Whereas this stuff here, it's so like soft and gentle, and like the little like, I don't know, tinklings that are in there, and the strings and all. I'm like, ooh. Like, and that like, I think I found with his films, the score does a lot of the heavier lifting when it's to hit home the emotion.
Yeah, yes.
Like there's a lot.
And he always gets the spot on. Like he always seems to, whatever the movie, he seems to get nailed that. Like.
Because he has such a reputation as, like you say, like rigid or cold or whatever. But like each one of these films we've watched, bar Bottle Rocket, because it's a bit more of a lark and it's a bit, you know, a bit sillier. And you know, each one of these ones I've watched, I'm like on the verge of, like, I did have a proper cry watching.
Did you have a tear? Did you have a tear for this one?
Yeah, loads.
What bit?
You know when his wife says, "I love you, but I shouldn't have married you."
Yeah, that's tough. Like that's.
I wonder what those 12-year-olds thought of that. I mean, like, my God, what a line! And there isn't really like a she means it, and she doesn't take it back later. And he's like, "Yeah."
he's a wild animal, but that's you know.
No.
There's a couple of bits. There's a bit where the wife. Like is wiping the mud off Ash's face.
Yeah.
And she's like, we're all a bit different. Oh, especially him. Like, and like that scene there like really gets me. I'm like, oh, like, you know, because
Terry's a crier.
I'm a crier. Since I got married, probably
the floodgates are open and they're not closed.
I realized that I probably hadn't cried since I was like 12 before I got married, and now I can't.
Now you can't turn it off.
Everything I can't. It's like it is like something you see in a sitcom where it's like I've opened it. You know, I've opened the vent. Yeah. So
I got the first time I watched this film, I got very like, oh no, I wasn't crying because I'm not a loser, but I did get emotional at the sort of the rising war cry version of Bogus Bunsen Bean.
I
love what this film does with that rhyme.
So good.
It's like a western though, like, you know.
Yeah, exactly. But it starts off as it is in the book, which is like a schoolyard song, you know. Even kids sing it, you know.
Yeah.
And then they turn it into that, you know. And like so slowly good. Over the film, it falls back into the score.
Yeah.
Then it becomes that kind of Western, like it's like the whole film is a Mexican standoff waiting to happen, where they're just perpetually playing that under the thing. And then it takes off there.
Yeah.
And it's like, I felt why he wanted to make this film in terms of his own connection to it as a child in that moment, because I have that connection. And I was like, that's a trick. That's a film trick.
But can I ask
you? To make me emotional.
Did you find that the film lived up because you were such a big fan of the book? Like, obviously you enjoy the film, but like, did it tick all your boxes in terms of what a film on the book should have been?
I mean, the book shouldn't be a film. I think that this only works because of what's been added to it.
Yeah.
And what's added to it has like little flaws in places. I don't really know how I feel about like the very final beat of this film.
Yeah,
where they all go to a supermarket. You know, but it's interesting. but now they're all in a supermarket in a sewer, and I feel a bit sad for them.
That's
but
the thing.
They've sort of
vermin. You know what I mean? Like, but it's like. It's that false hope. It's like, oh, we're all dancing around and we're happy. And it's like, then if you take a step back and it's like, oh, we got one over on Bogus Bunsen Bean, but also you are proper like scavengers and like you will be looked upon by any human.
I'm not sure what they're. I really like the supermarket was called Bogus Bunsen Bean Mega Stores or something like that. I love the corporate reach of these three farmers. Yeah. It's very funny.
But even and, earlier on in the movie, I think when the whack bat scene, there's like a little plane that flies by and it has like Bogus Bunsen Bean supermarkets opening soon or whatever like that. Like, that's fucking dead.
Bean Air, Bean Security. Yeah. Like I love the megacorp of.
It's like they own the world. Of those,
which is like what they're written to be.
Yeah.
It's just a modern adaptation of
how
that idea.
How good is Michael Gambon as Bean? When he has the first meeting and they're like, he's like, what's all this about then? He's like, yes, how good to see you. Have you had any problem with foxes lately?
Fox problems?
just his delivery of it, like, it's so good.
I don't know how, I'm always amazed when a new actor rocks up to a Wes Anderson movie and just completely nails the tone.
Yeah.
Because the tone is consistent through all the films. Yeah. And it's not something easy to do.
No. But,
and people don't do it. They don't copy each other. But they fit in. And it's like, I remember the whole time I was watching Twin Peaks season 3 when it came out, I was just like, how do these people know how to consistently tap into this very specific style that isn't just people doing impressions of the one guy who knows how to do it, you know? But there is something that you have to acknowledge and put into your performance
something
to fit into these films.
Yeah.
And it's the same, like, you know, like Ralph Fiennes taps into the same thing, but he's not just doing what Mike Gambon is doing in this film.
I actually forgot when we were watching Zisu, like, he has a small part. He's like the financier in Zisu.
Oh, right.
But he doesn't get a chance to kind of, he's very much like, hello, darling, how are you?
Yeah.
You know, and again, in keeping up, but in this one here, there's just, he flickers between bored and like menacing.
You have to be incredibly funny to know that that's going to be funny.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? To like sit in the recording booth and say, any fox problems?
Yeah,
and not, any bloody fox problems, lads? Yeah, you know, to just know that that's what is needed and that that's going to work. It takes a lot sometimes to tell, particularly people who are in my experience, jumping between actors and comedians and directing them in comedy shows. It can be very hard to convince an actor to just do what they're good at and just play it quiet and seriously. And trust me, that's going to be the funniest thing you can do.
Yeah.
And I'm always amazed at everyone in these movies really just like sitting back into them. I feel like, being hilarious, you know.
I feel like now, like, or at this stage, this is his, what, sixth movie? So you're probably, if you know you're signing up to a, but probably since like Tenenbaums, you know, if you're going, if you're signing up to a Wes Anderson movie, that it's going to be a certain tone or a certain, you know, style to it and all that.
I don't know about your plan to watch them all back to back. I think that might not be helping. That's one thing I might
interject
with.
Why do you say that? Interesting.
I just think that if to enjoy this, you might need to watch to break to you. A change is as good as a break, you know. I think when I watched the Beatles documentary, I had to break it into 40-minute chunks because if I watched any more than that, I would still be watching it, but I wasn't paying attention, you know, in the way that I wanted to, and I think. I could be wrong, that if you just plowed through all these and you didn't interrupt them with other styles,
with normal
you could
movies,
kind of settle into the ride a little bit too much.
Interesting.
And it could just kind of wash past very quickly and you wouldn't be able to see the films from each other, you know?
So you feel like there's not as big of a gap or as there perhaps should be in between them, or there should be more things watched. Of different styles.
Yeah, and, you know, I don't think anyone is expecting you not to do that. So, I don't think this is a hot take of any kind.
But that's interesting because to be honest, like, you know, generally the only movies.
I'm not saying your whole podcast is flawed. I'm just saying your whole podcast is flawed. He's got less movies than I thought he did.
He only has 10
when I was looking at. So I'll give him that terms of if that was ever the way he intended people to watch his entire back catalog
in a 10 week spell.
When I said to Andy 10 movies, like 10. Yeah. But then I said we did 20 something Marvel movies. Like,
this is,
you know,
just,
I mean,
this is just phase one.
Yeah.
So
exactly. Of the Andersonverse, the Westverse.
But I just have
there,
a feeling.
Was there stop motion in his films before this?
There was stop motion in Zisu. Yeah. There was a little bit I noticed this time around, that like the fish and
because
stuff in Zisu.
He really adapts stop motion and just like model work and animation into all of his films from here on.
There is a bit.
in a way that you can tell this film really, really, like, even in Grand Budapest, like, so much of like just exterior shots are I think they're models, and
I think I saw that myself. Yeah,
in French Dispatch, there's like some kind of like comic strip animation at one point. Which I found very interesting. But that's why I think, like, it, for me anyway, I'm finding it very interesting to see how, like, oh, and here's the change here, you know, of his style, how it's evolving, or, you know, reverting, or, you know, back to norm. Like, you can see the tone maybe is the same, or like the, like you say, the vibe, the, that universe. But for me, looking at his technique as a filmmaker, I think is very interesting.
How do you find his, like, his storytelling and his kind of, like, because for me it's like the characters know that they know what the script is. Do you know what I mean? Like, it's very choreographed. This one especially, because it's stop motion, so like literally every little inch of it can be exactly the way he wants it. But like, everyone moves very deliberately, like they're always hitting a mark. You know, like, they always know where they're supposed to stand. And it's like, I say this line and now I stand over here. But it comes across to me as like very decisive in an enjoyable way, where it's like everyone is just very, everyone is very competent at the things they care about.
They very much give themselves over to him, I think. They say, like, okay, what do we do? And I think Gene Hackman, you know, he had a bit of trouble with him, but like everybody else, like you say, they seem like they know their mark, they've rehearsed it, they know I have to stand here, because when I stand here, I'm framed perfectly by these two pictures that make it, you know, man and a woman or whatever, and I'm in the middle here, I'm the child.
Well, that's probably why
I guess what I'm asking is, like, do you as an audience member, like, accept that, or do you find it weird?
I
find it really fun to watch. I can see how people would be really put off by it.
I find it fun now. I just kind of get the impression that this is, like, because he's so, like, I don't want to say controlling in a bad way, but he knows exactly what he wants from his movies and how they look. So I get the impression that he was just rubbing his hands together at the idea that he could literally, like you said, control every single inch of what everyone looks like, where everyone's standing, the exact set, like, to minute detail, which he does anyway, but for this one specifically with the characters.
The big thing that journalists were saying at the time was, like, oh, it was inevitable that he'd make an animated movie because his live action movies are as close to animation as a live action movie is going to be. That was the kind of crack, and he didn't seem too impressed by that when the interviewer brought that up to him. He was just like, the response in the interview was like,
"The fuck do you know?"
It's like, that's, I guess it's a simplification, but it's also correct,
kind of true.
But you know what's important is that it works. If it didn't work,
I don't think there's anything in this movie that doesn't work. Like, to the casting of Willem Dafoe as the Rat.
I wish I knew that after, because I hate after I watch a movie and I'm like, oh, that was voiced by him. If I'd have known that, I would have appreciated it more when I was listening to it.
I would have perked up.
Yeah, I would have been like, wow, he's doing a great job
in it. Like, he's like West Side Story, the way he walks and he's clicking his fingers. Yeah. And the score for him was like, they're playing it's not the mouth organ, but like the beom, beom, beom.
Oh yeah, you know
that kind of like thing. It's like, oh,
the whole thing is like, it's my job.
I love his death so much. It's like, it implies so much backstory and relationship. I love that they're friends from the old days of whatever they were when they were young.
Got no
sure she lives. We all did. like there's just so much. There's little exchanges between them that just give you so much insight, and you don't need to know the specifics because it feels real. You know, a delicious drop of the fire. You know, the it's feeding in the thing, cider,
like melted gold.
I love all these films have this weird ability to turn something you've heard once before into like a timeless creed that apparently we all recognize and live by.
I'd give my life up for that cider, definitely, in a heartbeat. And like, you even get like Bill Murray as the Badger, Like, you know, I know he puts Bill Murray in all his movies, but it's talking about maximizing minutes again, like in the Royal Tenenbaums here. Yeah. That scene where they're like, don't buy the house, Foxy.
Yeah.
And he's like, I'm buying the house. Like, the cuss you are.
I love that. I love that. Fantastic Mr. Fox is.
You cussing
money.
At me? Yeah. You're not gonna cuss at me. It's like, yeah. <It's> just kind of... I love when they, but like, it's those little bits. Like, that's what kind of made me think that, like, I don't know if kids would like it, because when they get all at each other, it's slightly more sinister than you'd see in a kid's thing. Or when they're eating,
yeah,
it's like,
the rat is terrifying. Yeah. The rat is deliberately, intentionally uncomfortable to look at, kind of design. Yeah.
I have, like, I have a two-year-old.
And he dies.
He gets electrocuted.
We don't know how. We know that there was a knife in that fight, you know?
So I thought he got electrocuted. I thought it was, because it's like, you see...
that's convenient.
Yeah, that's what I thought it was. Because, like, high voltage where they're fighting, and then you see, a lightning bolt. So I figured I see.
So what you're saying is that it wasn't that Mr. Fox disarmed him and stabbed him.
It wasn't that. It wasn't like the guy.
I must have dreamt it.
See, that was my interpretation of the film. It's probably because I watched it on a train.
Yeah.
Who knows what else?
Just talking about
saw
kids
it wasn't there.
Watching it. Like, I have a 2-year-old daughter, and I was telling her, will we watch Fantastic Mr. Fox? And she got very excited and was watching it with me. Kind of in it. She was like, oh, look at all the animals, blah, blah, blah. And then when Bean shows up, it's like, don't like the man.
Yeah.
No, and I'm like, he is kind of terrible, menacing.
You'll watch it. It's good.
You'll sit there and you'll watch it. I honestly think, like, all the voice performances in this are perfect. Yeah. Like, even you get Owen Wilson for a scene.
Yeah.
You're dead.
I tell you, I have the best whack bat player we ever had. I've such a newfound respect. That was very good, by the way.
Thanks.
I have such a newfound respect for Owen Wilson. If nothing else, so far, Owen Wilson's stock has only just skyrocketed. I didn't even know he was all these films.
He co-wrote
the first three. I had no idea he was even capable of writing a movie. I thought he was just actor Owen Wilson.
He hasn't written a movie since.
Doesn't need to.
I mean, living off that Tenenbaums money.
Yeah, he's going out on a high. He can't top that.
I thought his performance in Zisu was probably his best performance I've ever seen.
I would say between that and his performance in Loki. Remember when he was
back in
Loki
as well? Yeah, I thought he was great in Loki. Actually, he gave
my favorite thing in that show.
Yeah,
yeah.
Like,
which is apparently coming back, by the way.
They definitely. They're gonna milk that one dry. That was
one of the good ones of Phase 4. That's what I'll say. That's my hot take.
Very, very uneven.
The current phase. Yeah. The what the fuck is media phase.
Exactly. It's all in the pot. Throw it in. I don't know, I really resonated with the theme of, oh, I can't do what I want to do anymore. He's like, I'm a newspaper man. I can't go hunt chickens all the time. I can't be a fox. Yeah, I have that weird, between myself. I am a husband and a father, but I also like to stay up really late. And I'm like, but I can't do that all the time anymore. You know,
so I identified with Mr. Fox.
Yeah, he has stealing his chickens. I have staying up till 2 o'clock playing video games or watching movies.
I don't know what the urge I have is, but it's like
we're wild animals, Andy.
Well, it's like 8-year old me is suddenly an adult. I'm like, if I can stay up as late as I want, I'm going to stay up as late as I can physically keep my eyes open. And I don't know why. I have the thought.
George Costanza, like, I can't keep doing this to myself.
Wake up every morning tired, like, why
did I stay up that extra 3 hours last night? You know, but there was something when I was watching it this time. I was like, oh yeah, like there is that longing for my 20s self, even though in my 20s, it was almost reverse. Where in my 20s, I was like, you know what, I'm going to be happy when I'm not drinking all the time and settle down and, you know.
And now you're like, party.
Yeah, I'm like, oh, God.
Frank the Tank.
My midlife crisis is really going on.
I think it's just
early.
Those chickens look fucking delicious in this film, you know?
My teeth are more like the opossum's teeth in this. You have different teeth.
I have to say, one of my favorite bits of the whole animation thing was just them in the tunnels. Like just digging down, digging straight, and then going through it. I'm amazed. I don't know how they would have done it with stop motion to have them all. Maybe it was a gel or something. And they just, I don't know. But, you know, like, I assumed, oh, well, they must have CGI'd that.
I would like to know everyone's opinion on the wolf.
I don't know what this... I've been trying to figure it out for years. I don't know what this... I love it.
I have a phobia of wolves. What a beautiful creature. Wish him luck, boys.
Good luck out there.
For starters, but I have no idea what...
It moves me.
I have a lot of guesses as to what it represents. It's not definitive at all, you know?
It moves me every time. I'm always moved by it, but I don't know.
Wow, powerful.
Powerful, that's the word. Like, I'm like...
You know what? I think I may have fallen asleep with that.
Brilliant.
What?
Brilliant.
Oh, it must have. I have no recollection of this wolf, and I've seen the movie yesterday.
He's like talking about it all the time, like, you know, wolf, what wolf, you know,
he's afraid of wolves.
Not so much afraid of them as I have a phobia of them, but
You know what, I do remember seeing it the first time around, now that I see it, a picture of it here,
and I just love that, like, yesterday.
What does he ask him? Is it something about, are we going to have a good spring or something like that?
Yeah, he says it in French.
Like a prophecy kind of.
He says it in French. Yeah. It was like, I was asking for him for a hard winter.
Yes.
If he thinks we're in for a hard winter.
Thanks for a very hard winter. Yeah.
But like, there's this ability like this film has for me to like pull off these amazing set pieces. You know, the whole thing where he's like, hold on, he's like, I'm an athlete. And he does like, tag the browsers, you know, and like he's doing the whole whack bat thing in the compound. And then like he pops up like, hot box. Yeah. And you have that scene and it's amazing. And they jump out the ramp and it's like, holy swearing cuss. And then they pop down and then he's able to just slow it down with this whole thing with the wolf. And I'm like, adrenaline rush.
There's something going on with like so they all start off in their animals. They have jobs. They have modern jobs.
Yeah.
And they're all a bit, Fox is unhappy with it. And then over the course of the film, they kind of regress through their own identities all the way back down to their Latin names, which is just so, like, you know.
Yeah, that's so funny. That's
exactly what Wes would like. And then they kind of have this, so they use their raw animal ability, including being a demolitions expert, to mount this fucking assault on Roald Dahl's childhood town and a big farm. And then it's like they reach this, like, after they pull everything off and everyone's learned their lesson and everyone's learned a bit about who they are, it's like they reach this weird god wolf. It's like their primordial, the one thing that isn't wearing a tie.
Yeah,
you know,
doesn't speak.
Like aside from all the chickens and dogs they don't give a fuck about. You know, and just have this moment. And then the film ends with them living in a supermarket in a sewer system. Well, now's the time to buy, you know?
Yeah.
And it's like they return to it. That's why I'm not sure about the ending. I'm like, if it means that, that's cool. I get it.
Yeah, because I think it does. They go in opposite directions as well. Like the wolf goes left and they go right, or, you know.
Yeah.
And it's like we're moving away. From
that. He gives them like a "you did it" or a like we're all in this together kind of a thing.
I've never been able to work it out, and that's the thing. Like, and I was hoping when I was reading the thing, it's like, oh, maybe there'll be something about the
wolf. That's what I think. That's why I think it's great to talk about, because I feel like most people really enjoy it, but it's like, what does it mean to anyone? You know,
it's really striking, really powerful, but I can't quite wrap my brain around it at all. Like,
That maybe I don't have any more notes on this one myself, Terry. I don't know if you have stuff you want to talk about on it.
No, it continues the tradition of having a great soundtrack as well.
Hell,
you know, you got like Beach Boys in there.
The best opening, that Heroes and Villains at the start was just like
I know you prefer that version. I prefer the Brian Wilson smile version. Yeah.
Oh.
It just makes me sad.
I like 20-year-old Brian Wilson's vocals rather than 60-year-old Brian Wilson.
It just makes me sad. It's like, and you're out of the band. Get out of here. You know, we're releasing Smiley Smile. Like,
I just thought, Street Fighting Man was a great. That was a moment when that kicked
that's your
in.
Cheer moment.
Yeah, that's my cheer moment.
A lot of Burl Ives in the background. I don't know if you guys are familiar with Burl Ives.
I didn't pick up on it. No,
soundtrack is a good listen to. Just on
I was listening
Spotify.
To it today.
It's good
on the way home. Yeah, it was good. It
starts
was good.
With Davy Crockett as well. Like, had it on this morning. I was like,
Davy Crockett.
Perfect.
The last thing I'll add is that the bit that made me laugh on the train, which I was holding in the whole time, but the bit that got me because it surprised me and I wasn't expecting it was when Christofferson shouted, divide that by 9, please.
Oh, I love it.
It really just tripped me up and came out of nowhere. it's just that like jokes about competence and just,
there was like, I pay my bills on time. I've always had good credit. Yes. How'd you get a platinum card?
That's one last. Like, I love that's Fox's. His great vice is just that he's bad with money.
Yeah.
And he's overconfident. and I pay my bills on time. Just, you know.
That's a great performance, you know, as Kylie. Yeah. Like, I think it's so good. I don't know, like, if I'm talking about like favorite joke in it, like this time around, I don't know, like I found Ash to be such a funny character. Even she's like, I'm your lab partner. It's like, no, you're not. You're disloyal. For some reason, just his disdain for everything had me really funny. Or like in that scene, he's like, come on out, Ash. He's going to finish. He's like, huh, I'm out, coach. I'm really feeling it. He's like, am I getting better? He's like, you're curse can't get any worse. And then he keeps asking me, he's like, let's just say you're improving and leave it at that. And no, this time around, because I think in the past, he kind of annoyed me. And this time around, I really appreciate Jason Schwartzman's delivery of the lines so much more.
It was kind of almost like his Rushmore character.
Well, that's what Steven's
like
saying.
Wes Anderson, essentially.
Yeah.
It's not the, you know, erudite child playwright prodigy. This is the actual one.
I don't know what little fun British rhymes the little English foxes were saying in the original book, but I do think this is better for this film than whatever those characters did. Probably very little.
Yeah.
We give it a rating.
Sure.
Care to go first, Andy?
I'll give it. Look, I'm sorry. I know you both cared a lot about this movie. I would probably put it... What did I give Bottle Rocket?
Yeah, 6.5, I think you gave it.
I'd give this a 7.
Okay. That's the same as Rushmore.
And
blasphemous. Blasphemous.
7's fine. 70%, it's a B.
Steven?
I guess... Yeah, I mean... It's on my list of films, you know, where I'm like, yeah, watch it again. And to be honest, that means it's an 8 at least, you know. Probably a 9, I think. Probably a 9.
I'm a 9 here.
Yeah, I think it's a 9 for
me. A couple of 9s, man.
Yeah, I'm a 9. It'll never not be entertaining for me. Like, you know what I mean?
I mean, a big part of that, and I'll acknowledge it, is that I do feel like I'm in the Venn diagram, you know.
Of
little boys who grew up on Fantastic Mr. Fox and likes pausing the film and reading the jokes in the newspaper.
Yeah.
You know? So it's like, it's for me.
That's a 9 out of 10s man talking right there.
Yeah.
Well, look, on that note, should we get our plugs in, Terry?
Yeah. Steven, have you got anything you want to plug before we...
When's this going out?
This is going out, so...
Hang on.
Let's do some maths here. So
next week we have Life Aquatic coming out, then we have Darjeeling, and then this. So 3 weeks.
Let's get a date
April 20th. Okay, great. Yeah, that's you're definitely before show then. No. Incredibly?
This.
Yeah, okay, great.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, great. Hey, we got a film read. Star Wars is in Vicar Street. It's been on sale for 2.5 years, and there's still a couple of tickets left. yeah, it's Film Reads. It's our show. We take films, we pump them full of jokes. It's also available in podcast form. So if you're like, that sounds shit, I won't enjoy that, check out the podcast. It's all there for free. I think you'll probably enjoy it. If you like this podcast, it's about films. I can't
recommend it highly enough.
Same.
It's fantastic. Me and Andy have
such a good show.
We've been numerous times.
Shawshank was we saw at like the Vodafone Comedy Festival, I remember.
And we got to see Silence of the Lambs as well as part of the Fringe a couple of years ago when, you know, things were still
It's such a good laugh. I would highly recommend it.
Yeah. If you want to go and laugh for an evening, it's you know.
Yeah.
I will modestly agree with everything these two men have said.
And on that note, you can catch us on Instagram at What's So Great About Pod, on Twitter at WSGA Pod. You'll find links to everything we do there, including latest episodes and the Patreon.
Ooh, the Patreon. Well,
yes.
Over behind the paywall, we have two tiers you can subscribe to. We have your pay what you want tier, which is literally you pay what you want. We call that our Hungry Hearts. Or you can pay the $5 original tier, our Big Shots. For both of those prices, you get 4 extra bonus episodes per month. You get our returning Put It in H podcast. So we're working our way through season 3. And that plus you get like 3 other top 5 episodes. You get, you know, we've done film pitches to one another. A lot of improv-y kind of loosey-goosey ones there. You also have access to our back catalogue of What's So Great About. So you get access to our What's So Great About MCU, What's So Great About 90s action movies, What's So Great About Ryan Gosling, and What's So Great About Big Willie's Flops, a.k.a. Will Smith's bad films. He's in the news, guys. You want to hear us talk about him. And
how's that podcast going to end?
we're capping it off with the slap coming up
next. We are going to do a deep dive on Slapgate as well. But you'll know that I was right. He's not okay.
I'll save it for the Patreon.
So a lot of good stuff there. If you can't afford the pay what you want, literally you can pay whatever, you can pay, you know, a euro if you want.
No excuse.
But if you can't afford it, that's fine. I know we're still technically in a pandemic. I'll let you off. But you can do me a favor. You can give me a rating or a review. Now, Andy.
Yes.
Did you know that Bean likes to have 2 to 3 bottles of cider an evening? Now, I don't want a 2-star review or a 3-star review.
Unbelievable.
I want a 5-star review.
How does he do it, folks?
I was panicking. I realized I had no number to think of.
You had no bit.
I had no bit whatsoever. And I was like, oh, that woman picked up 2 bottles of cider. Anyway, yeah. So give us a rating on Apple Podcast, on Spotify, or whatever your podcatcher of choice.
And give Dream Guns podcast
a
rating and review while you're there.
Yeah.
And tell them What's So Great About sent you.
Also, you know, tag us on social media, tell a friend, tag a friend, you know, do all our marketing for us. Make a friend and get them to give us a review. you know, do all that hard work for us, please. You know.
The reviews might not be great, but at least they've got stars on them.
Exactly.
Well, look, Stephen, I wanted to say thank you again very much for joining us.
Thanks
for
having me. That's really enjoyed this. Anytime you need someone to talk about films, I'm always here with my opinions, with my middle-of-the-road safe opinions.
Excellent.
Not pissing
anyone
off. Terry's
too far this end and I'm too far this end, so you right in the middle is the perfect chemistry.
I'd prefer him a little bit over more to my side, to be honest.
Whenever you need a coward for your podcast, I'm always here.
Hey, I'm the podcast coward here. That's my shtick.
Well, I can see how you didn't like it and you liked it. That's my opinion.
Well, look, on that note, folks. Terry, do you want to add?
No, I'm just waiting for you.
I don't know why I've been forced into say this, folks. I love you, okay? Yeah. I love you as a friend.
And you get the big L from me behind the paywall. You got to pay for it. Otherwise, we will see you next week for Moonrise Kingdom.
Oh wow! Excellent. Yeah. Keep me company. Boom.
That was great fun.
there on a mountaintop in Tennessee. Green estate in the land of the free. Raised in the woods so he knew every tree. Killed him a bar when he was only three. Davy, Davy Crockett, king of the wild frontier. Fought single-handed through the Injun War, till the Creeks was whipped and peace was in store. And while he was handling this risky chore, made himself a legend forevermore. Davy, Davy Crockett, the man who don't know fear. He went off to Congress and served a spell, fixing up the government and laws as well. Took over Washington, so I heard tell, and passed up the crack in the Liberty Bell. Davy, Davy Crockett, seeing his duty clear. When he come home, his politicking was done. Why, the Western March had just begun. So he packed his gear and his trusty gun, and lit out a grinning to follow the sun. Davy, Davy Crockett, leading the pioneers.